Appreciate you being here with me today and just chatting with me about, you know, business. And, you know, it's always fun for me to, I work in a pretty evolving industry in and of itself. And so it's always interesting for me to talk to people from different aspects of the business world. And, you know, there's always something to learn from everybody. And everybody's got a truth nugget from their journey in their own way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've done so much stuff from real estate to diamonds and cars and invention and captain. And I mean, it's just, we've been all over the place. It's just like, try something new and see, have some fun at it, and then sell that business and then go find something else to do. And it's worked for us.
Yeah. So tell a little bit about, like, what can you kind of dive into that a little bit about your business background? It is pretty diverse, I think is a good way to put it.
Diverse. You know, I feel like I have, you know, a little OCD, a little ADD probably. And I mean, I just remember sitting in school and just having a really hard time focusing. And so I would get into a new subject and then it would just kind of get boring and then it would just kind of fade away. So I think that's kind of how my business career has been. You know, I just find something I like, I dive into it. Like, I always loved getting a new job because just consuming all of that new information. It's like, here's how you do this. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do this. I love that. And it was the most exciting part. And then you get into the day-to-day grind and it's just like, oh, this sucks, man. Like, I didn't want to keep absorbing and learning information. So yeah, I've been all across the board from, so my first job that really gave me, like, kind of let me do my thing was at this little soccer and volleyball store called Sportworks. I was 17 years old working there. First day, the guy gave me a key to the store. He gave me a code to the alarm and just kind of let me spread my wings and said, you know, where do you, you know, want to fit in? And I ended up getting into, like, ordering the product and organizing everything and, like, remodeling the stores and working on the finances. And so I got to dabble in a bunch of stuff at 17, 18 years old. So I was actually working full time there and then going to classes whenever I could. So he was really flexible. So, you know, I'd go there, open up the store, work till like 9 o'clock, and then go to a couple of classes, and then go back to the store and work. And then I go back to a couple of classes and I go back and close the store at night. I loved every second of it. So from there, I just got into all kinds of different things.
Yeah. So is that's kind of the beginning of what made you want to do your first business venture? Or was there another, like, what kind of got you into your first business venture per se?
You know, I had a bunch of ideas. I actually had, so when I was at that soccer and volleyball store, we had sales reps that would come in, like the same guys that sold the, you know, Johnson Erection Company t-shirts to, you know, whatever company was out there. Like, those sales reps would go into all those stores. So those guys were coming in, we were working with screen printers, and this is when WWJD, like, everybody's wearing What Would Jesus Do stuff, and it was like everywhere. But it was also the same time that Bill Clinton was getting his rocks off in the Oval Office with Monica Lewinsky. And I thought, why don't we make shirts that say WWCD, What Would Clinton Do? And I wanted to do it, but, you know, I was 17 years old, and did I have a couple $100 to make the first one of shirts? Sure. But it was like, I don't know anything about business. I didn't know about taking it on myself. And I talked myself out of it at an early age. And I wish I had pursued it. I mean, today's kids at 15, 16, 17 years old just have so many opportunities with the internet and, like, so many resources. So I've had ideas. I've had a couple other invention ideas since, and it just never really, they ended up being much bigger ideas than I thought they were and much more expensive to pursue. So I just kind of, I guess I always thought about that stuff. I just never really pursued it until I started my screen printing business. And then I was in real estate. So that's kind of your own business person. So it just kind of spiraled from there.
I find that to be the case with a lot of people who have great ideas. Like, I've met so many people who have great ideas, and many of them think that was the hardest part of it, was coming up with the great idea. And there's usually a ton, that's just when the very beginning, all the work still actually has to be done to make it, you know, actually a reality. And it obviously usually costs a lot. And even the best person, no matter how well you kind of estimate, you know, what it's going to entail, there's always unforeseen things. It's always more expensive. It always takes a little bit longer. Like, it's just the nature of, I think, you know, projects and certainly being an entrepreneur as well.
Well, I think the hard part, especially for even for me, is like, I'm the idea guy. Can I sell? Yeah. I mean, I've sold cars, I've sold houses, I've sold diamonds. I sell the biggest things that most people ever buy, but that's a real relationship business. And that's where, you know, if I can get in front of somebody and talk face to face, I can build their trust and I can help them through that transaction. Selling this thing online is not that kind of transaction. You know, it's just more transactional than it is that relationship thing. So that was really the hard part for me to implement, is going from creative guy to sales guy. And so very early on, I picked up a partner, and, you know, he kind of handles that side of it. So he picks up where I leave off, and then, you know, we generate ideas off each other and try to figure out what the best route is for the company. But he's great with graphic design. He's great with the with the website. He's great with sales. I mean, he's gotten us, admittedly, like basically almost every major presentation we have. I mean, we've pitched to Macy's and, you know, Ralph Lauren and like every major brand. So, and he pretty much set up all of those meetings.
Yeah. Now, would you say that's kind of would you say that's the biggest challenge for, cause I know a lot of people that do startups, they have an idea, they'll start a business, they kind of get it up to a certain point, and then it's, you know, it's time to scale it. It's time for someone else to kind of take point on it and that has that expertise. Do you think like recognizing that in yourself and then making that transition to bring someone on and, you know, to continue scaling and growing the company the way you envision it is one of the challenges early on of like, of transitioning, of starting, of creating a startup and then, you know, making it into an established business?
Yeah. I mean, that is a skill in and of itself is growing. So my wife and I are amazing at finding a niche, exploiting that niche, building a business. But then once it comes time to like really hiring people and putting into place the, you know, the systems that are what make that thing run, that's not really our thing. So we've done it in real estate. We had two commercial buildings with 32 offices. We did it with our boat. We have a yacht charter business that is, you know, could we add more boats? Yes. We need to find more captains. We find more crew. It's just like, we found this great niche. We are like one of the top booked boats. We're number the top rated boat in Los Angeles, which is a highly competitive market.
Yeah.
But that's where we end. Like we're good. We're good to have created it. It's like, okay, someone buy it and take it and grow it on to what you want it to be. We've laid groundwork, and let's go find another niche that we can come up with, which my wife just did. So I'm really excited about working on this next one.
we can talk about that if you want to as well.
We'll come back to it. It's perfect for the title of your podcast, what we're doing. So you're going to be like, oh my God, it's brilliant.
That's awesome. So when you're talking about bringing on somebody into your business, you know, and you're looking for the right partner, like what do you look for? What do you think someone should look for, you know, when looking for the right people to bring on at key positions or as a full business partner?
Well, there's a great book called Rocket Fuel, and that talks specifically about that. In any given relationship, there's going to be one creative and one implementer. Look at the Disneys. Walt Disney was obviously the creative, but if there was no Roy Disney, there would be no Disney World, because Walt would just be cutting checks and there'd be no money in the account because I got to go build this. I got to go do this.
Right.
That's who I am in this relationship. But with my wife, on the boating business, she is so organized and detailed. You know, it was my idea to do a yacht charter business, but it was her implementation of, here's the contract. We need them to sign a waiver. We need them to do this. We need to do this. Here's how we book it. She designed the website. She put up all the photos. She does all the social media. So, you know, I manage the boat, make sure that the oil's changed and like that it's running. She makes sure we get booked. And so that just kind of happened organically. And we know where we fit in when we work together. My business partner with Million Dollar Collar and Go Tylus, you know, he feels a little bit creative sometimes, which he certainly is. So we still struggle a little bit, even 7 years later, of like, okay, here's, you know, you're doing this and I'm doing this, and let's just, you know, we try to weave together. But identifying what those roles are early and saying, look, you're responsible for this, I'm responsible for that, will help with butting heads later. But if you're looking for a partner, considering a partner, Rocket Fuel is a great book to consume.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate the suggestion. I'm always looking for new books to gain insight from. So I appreciate that. Yeah. Now, we've touched on it sort of a couple times here, but with your latest thing here with Million Dollar Collar, it actually required a patent to be obtained, from what I understand. And, you know, this is something that I'm growing more interested in as well, is learning about patents and that process. Can you share a little bit about that experience? I mean, obviously it's different for different industries or the type of patent you're going after, perhaps. But can you kind of explain like a little bit about that experience, cost, time, the types of obstacles that you generally would face?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, Sarah Blakely famously wrote her own patent for Spanx. And like I just said, I am not the detail oriented cross your T's and dot your I's kind of guy. And I knew that if I was going to invest all of the money that we had, I mean, this idea came up on my wedding day. And so we had wedding money left over and we had stuff. And, you know, I showed my new bride what my idea was. And she goes, dude, that's go for it. Like, I love it. Go for it. So knowing that I was investing all of that and I was going to spend the next, you know, decade or so trying to build this company and get it licensed into a major brand, I wanted to make sure it was protected. So I found the best patent attorney in town. It was very, very not inexpensive. He was, I think he was $559 an hour when I started, and he gave himself a nice $20 an hour raise. So $579 or $589 an hour. I think he was close to $600 by the time we were all said and done. But the process is long. You know, the goal of the patent attorney is to write it as big and as broad as possible. And the patent offices, they want it as small and as refined as possible. So it, that's what the battle is. And the every time it's, you know, how much can we get away with? And they're like, no. And how much can we get away with? And they say no. And so each time it goes back and forth, there's a cost and there's a time span. So the first check you write after, if you have an idea, Google the heck out of it, go to USPTO, which is the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and you can search in there for key terms and keywords, which I did. I didn't find anything that stood out as it would be relating to my product. The first check is to write to an attorney. They do a patent search, which is between, you know, $1,000 and $3,000, depending on who you use and how detailed it is. So he went and did a deep dive. He found nothing. So I was like, okay, we're on the right track. Nobody else is talking about this. Nobody else is doing this. So then it's, once you write that check, let me tell you, it is $1,000, you know, four and five figure checks, like monthly for the next foreseeable future. He's like, oh, I can get this done for like 20 grand, blah, blah, blah. We'll knock this out. And, you know, we're six figures into this thing and it's, the costs don't go down. Once you do get the patent, then you have 6 months to decide if you want to go international with it. So, you know, there's the patent pending process, there's a provisional patent process, but once you go from pending to issued, you only have 6 months to decide. And most companies don't have enough sales to say, yeah, I want to go for a worldwide patent. It's going to be $250,000. Let's go and protect the thing worldwide. You just don't have that kind of time frame unless you've got deep pockets behind you. So it's a lot of, where do we think this can go? And should, how much money can we afford to like lay out up front? And then each year that you have it, there's maintenance fee and that goes up because they're assuming that you're growing a business. So you should be making more money so you can pay more money. And it's just like, you know, for the first several years, it's just writing checks and I'm trying to catch up. But, you know, those little fidget spinners, a lady invented that for her son. He had ADD really bad. And she came up with this fidget spinner. She patented it. She couldn't afford the maintenance on it. And she lost the patent. And that became a $1 billion industry because she came up with this great idea. Like all the specs were out there and she couldn't pay the maintenance and she lost it. And then it became this massive industry. So you don't want to get that far down and get that, you know, $50,000, $80,000, $200,000 chunk of paper that says you've got this great idea and it's protected for the next 15 years. And then, you know, a $2,000 or $3,000 payment goes by and you're like, oh, there it goes. Yeah. Crap. You know,
I mean, that would be one.
It's tough. It's a long process.
Yeah. That would be one of the things when you're talking about the decision to whether or not to take the patent international or not. I mean, that would be one of my concerns as well. You know, if I had a product that I thought would be successful, but you don't really have the you're not in the position to really maybe do it, or you're debating whether or not to do it internationally, because it feels like, you know, internationally, I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but there are certain countries around the world that like to find other people's good ideas and then implement them and use them on mass scale. And so, you know, thinking ahead, like, you know, you're thinking globally, you're feasibly, if you don't take it internationally, you might lose out on even way more money than just what you would make here in the US, as you know, thinking about going through that process. It's a tough decision for sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the dress shirt industry is, you know, they did $1 billion, or a billion shirts were sold in the US in 2019. So that's a lot of market.
Yeah.
But over the world, I mean, there's 350 million people that live here, whatever the number is. You know, that's a fraction, a very, very small fraction of what dress shirts are worn in the world. And, you know, in Europe, it's huge. We sell a ton in Australia. We sell a ton in like Singapore. So, you know, making sure that those specific countries were covered was a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just you're betting on yourself and how much you're willing to put down on the table.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's funny. This process, I was joking with someone the other day, and this process very much reminds me of what we were talking about in my industry, is that it seems like the lawyers are the ones that always come out the best in no matter what the industry is. And you have to have good lawyers to do these things, but man, you do pay for a good lawyer. That's for sure. Certain.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's one of those things that you just have to have. And it's just, it's unfortunate that they always get paid. That there's no question they always get paid. So
that's true. That's true. This the $1 million collar, like, seems to me, so I'm terrible at, you know, like, I love the idea because I do have this problem. You know, I have shirts and this is very much a problem, but I find it daunting that for me to sew it, to actually install it. And to me, it seems like this is like a, would be fantastic to implement at the manufacturer level. And like you said, like, to pitch to, I don't know who makes the clothes for, you know, I don't know if Ralph Lauren actually makes their clothes, or if it's made all somewhere else and then Ralph Lauren just, you know, sells it, or I don't know how all that works. I'm sure you have a better idea, but it seems like if you implemented this at the time the shirt was made, that it would really solve your many problems from your perspective as well. Like, you know, simply you wouldn't have to worry about marketing to the average consumer because it's just being implemented at the base level. So it takes care of your sales and obviously gets a lot of distribution. Have manufacturers not been open to this idea? I would certainly pay a few more dollars for a shirt with this already installed in it.
Yeah. I mean, that was our pitch to them, was absolutely, like, you don't have to change anything. Why don't you just roll out the upgraded version of the current shirt you have, charge $5 more or $10 more and see what happens. And they were like, well, we don't ever want to say that this shirt's bad and this shirt's good. I'm like, dude, iPhone comes up with a new phone every year because technology gets better. Like, we're evolving. That's okay.
Yeah.
Not everybody loves $1 million collar. So you're still going to have a customer base that buys that shirt.
True.
But you're going to have a customer base that buys this shirt. So we got our patent issued in late 2015. And in like January, February, 2016, we were in front of Ralph Lauren and Perry Ellis and Proper Cloth, major, major, major brands. And, you know, we had no track record. We had no sales. We're like, maybe it's a good idea. I don't know if our customer really cares about this. So we're like, okay, well, we have to prove this. So we went direct to consumer. for the next several years and have been, and like you said, I think most of our clients do find it daunting. And so my job as the sales guy and the owner of the business is, how do I make it as easy as possible? So number one, your order comes with the very, very simple three-step instructions. My mom taught me how to sew. I just upgraded 25 shirts this morning for new inventory that we just got in. So it's, I'm an evolved idiot. I can sew and put these things in. It's really easy. So if your mom can sew or your sister, that's great. If not, we went to, for the last 5 years, we've gone to dry cleaning trade shows and pitched this to dry cleaners and said, look, the guy that's coming to you to clean his clothes and press them and pay someone to do that cares about the way he looks. Yeah. I promise you, if you present this properly, he'll give you $10 a shirt one time to get this put in and call it a day, and he will love you for it. And so instead of these dry cleaners making 25 cents laundering a shirt, they got a chance to actually make some good money on an upgrade. It's been a slow process, yeah, but we're in about 650 dry cleaners and tailors. So we have a map on our website. You can put in your zip code to find who's close to you. The next thing we have is a mail-in service. So I fought this forever. I'm like, why would you mail it in when there's 100,000 dry cleaners in the US? You've got instructions. Just walk into a place and say, do you do alterations? Yes. Put this in. Three steps. Open. Do it for me. I'd love it. Thank you. I'll give you $10 a shirt. So we did the VIP service. We've got a bunch of people that do that. The next thing we've evolved to is I buy Ralph Lauren shirts and Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein and Kenneth Cole. And we got Michael Kors in now. We buy those brands. I unbag them. I open them up. I install $1 million collar. I refold them back up like they did at the factory, put them back in the bag. And we sell shirts that you already know, the sizing you already know, the brands you already know, the quality you already know, and it's already got it in. So you can experience it once. And once you get it in one shirt and you wear it around and people are like, dude, I don't know what's wrong with that guy or what's different, but something looks better. Like he just looks more put together, and you start getting all these compliments and girls winking at you, and you're going to be like, dude, I have to get this in the rest of my shirts. And then you can come back and say, it's worth the process to do 10 more shirts that are in my closet or 20 more shirts that are in my closet, find that dry cleaner, find that tailor to put them in for you and get it done. So that's certainly been an issue, but we've now sold 411,000 units to 125 countries. I mean, we've got people that are willing to do it. And once they do, I mean, our average order is like 17 or 18 units. So it's not like all these people are buying a 5-pack and nothing ever happens. They're coming back, they're getting more, they're committing their closet to it. We've got one guy that literally on every ad, every post is like, this is my favorite thing. I have 95 shirts and every one of them has $1 million collar polos and dress shirts there. Like every single ad. I'm like, dude, you're the best, man. Thank you. But it's out there. I mean, it is a game changer. Once it's in, it lasts the life of the shirt. I mean, it absolutely changes the way a shirt looks and the way you feel in it. You stop tugging at it and adjusting constantly, and it just sits where it's supposed to sit. You don't have to think about it. And people are just complimenting you, and it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I can relate to this a bit. You know, I took home ec many, many years ago when I was a very young guy, and, you know, I sewed something, but I don't remember anything about how to do it. I can sew up a hole in my sock or something, you know, that's about my sewing skills. So, but taking it into a tailor, I mean, to me, that's the logical step. Or obviously I think the dry cleaners is another good move, because people who buy nice typically have nice clothes. And the one thing I do is that I iron my own shirts, but the plaque, you know, this area around the collar is always, I don't know, maybe I don't know how to iron properly, probably not, but it's always the most difficult part. You know, I can iron the rest of the shirt really beautifully. And that part, if it's, you know, just kind of jacked up, it's really tough to get it to lay just right. So to me, like, you know, it kind of alleviates that problem, and the rest of the shirt just kind of falls in place if the collar's like on point, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, the dress shirts were designed to be buttoned all the way up and worn with a tie. But for the last 15 or 20 years, ties have gone by the wayside more and more and more every year. Yeah. But dress shirts haven't changed. So there's no structure in this part of the shirt. Collar stays keep the collar up because they're giving structure to that part of the shirt. there's nothing in the placket where the buttons and the holes are. So that's why I said, when I came home from my wedding, I'm like, look, everything that's out there is around the collar. That was fixed in 1888. And there's been all these cheeky different ways to like play with a new way of collar stay. But at the end of the day, this part isn't the problem. It's the weight of the collar that collapses the front of the shirt. So, and especially when you wear a jacket, you notice that collar goes under there and the lapel eats up the front of your shirt. It's because there's no structure here. That's what $1 million collar does differently than anything else. It gives structure to the front of the shirt where it was never there. And there's just nothing you can do at production. Even if you add interfacing and you do bonded and you do all this stuff, after a few washes, that breaks down and it just doesn't have that new shirt look. And I've had a lot of customers that come back and say, I'll tell you what, I put this in a couple shirts that I had kind of stuck in the back of my closet because they just fell apart. Like they just wouldn't look good at all. And you like brought my shirts back to life for $10. I brought my $150 Robert Graham shirt back to life. And I love the way that it looks again. And now I'm wearing it. So I've just expanded my closet just by investing $10 into a couple of the shirts I have. So the beauty too, is it's so light and flexible. You can still button all the way up and wear a tie. Early on, we had a lot of guys in New York that were on like Wall Street and finance and lawyers that would, you know, tie all day. And then they'd pop it off at happy hour and be like, dude, I don't want to look like a schmuck at happy hour. I still want to look good and love this. It also helps too with that. You know, you usually get that gap between the first and second button when you wear a tie for whatever reason, it kind of pops out. This gives a little bit and kind of keeps that together. So it even tidies up wearing the tie. So this is one of those things that should be ubiquitous. There's no reason why it shouldn't be in every single shirt. And if you really don't like it, the same time you can have a tailor install it, you could have a tailor take this out in 5 minutes, put the shirt back together. And it's, if you want that sloppy crunch, a lot of people are like, oh dude, it's casual, man. And I like that look. And, okay. Well, this isn't for everybody. I know that, but.
I mean, you just mentioned another issue that I've certainly experienced, and that's always like the button spacing at the top as well. I know I'm kind of like getting particular about shirts here, I guess. And I normally wouldn't do that, but like sometimes the buttons just aren't spaced right. And like undoing just the top one isn't enough. Like you want to let that next one down too. But sometimes if the buttons aren't spaced right, like it just doesn't, it opens up too much, or it doesn't open enough, or it just doesn't, one side will open, you know, kind of peel, open up a little bit, but the other side does, it just doesn't look right. And like this just, you know, it looks uniform. It looks, like you said, it looks put together like every time, no matter what the shirt kind of looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes back to a little bit of my OCD is I like the balance and I like the symmetry. And, you know, my wife and I were dating, we're getting ready to go out and, you know, you're going to go out to a club or you're going to go out to dinner or whatever. What are you going to wear? Like the go-to thing for a guy is a dress shirt. You can tuck it in, you can untuck it, you can button it all the way up and wear a tie, you can roll the sleeves. Like there's just so many ways to wear it, but it looks really nice. And so she'd be done getting ready and be like, hey, are you ready to go? And I'm just like you, I'm ironing the placket, trying to get that stupid thing to sit. So then the left side's good. And then the right side looks bad. And then the right side's good. And then the left side's bad. And it's just like, you know, you put on starch, you know, this, like I said, this came about on my wedding day. I got married in Jamaica, toes in the sand, casual wedding, brand new, freshly pressed shirt. And before I can even say I do, it was collapsed under the placket of my shirt, my jacket. It was, the lapel had eaten it all up. And I just looked terrible on the biggest day of my life. And it was like, this doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah. Yeah. So continuing kind of along a little bit, you know, as you progress with this, like how do you know when you're going to get to a point to like actually maybe sell the business, or this both this business in particular, maybe, as well as like any business in general, like more generally to somebody who's maybe in another industry or has another type of business? Like, what do you look for when you're kind of ready to get to that point? How do you know you're there?
My wife and I pretty much, we get to a point where we're like, okay, this was fun. It's time. Like it just all of a sudden one day, it's just like, all right, it's time to move on. And it's hard because it's like, okay, you built this thing and you know what the potential is and you want to keep it going, but it's like, at the same time, you start to despise it and you're just like, oh God, I have to go do this again. You know, we had this charter business and it's like every weekend, all weekend long, we're you know, I was a chauffeur and she was a waitress, and we were, you know, waiting and trying to give these people like the best experience possible. And it took up every day of the weekend. And you're so exhausted by the end of the day. It's like, oh, my friends are going out. Let's go check it out. It's like, dude, I'm beat, man. I've been in the sun for 12 hours. I'm exhausted. So you start looking at what matters. It's like, okay, yeah, making a lot of money is great, but what are we missing out on? And at what point do we, you know, we've gotten established. We were struggling for, you know, the first 8 months or 9 months. And then all of a sudden we kind of hit a groove. And then it exploded, and it's just like, it was like hard to keep up with. And so that's usually at the point where we're like, okay, it's time. This thing, $1 million collar, we have to get a couple of big licensing deals. We have to get to the manufacturer. There's about three factories that make probably 80% of the shirts that come to the US. So, you know, once you get into one of those, it's on like Donkey Kong, as they say. And, you know, once we get there, that's a potential of like, okay, I've gotten this thing, you know, worldwide recognition or whatever recognition it needs, and then I'll feel good about it. But to this point, I don't feel like it's at a position where I can walk away and say, I've done the best that I could do, and this is as far as I can take it. So it's just, each thing is different though. You know, my only advice that I got when I was little, because my dad made the mistake, was using your name in a business makes it really hard to move on from that business. So every business that we've had has never been, you know, Rob's Consulting. Like, I can't sell Rob's Consulting business, because once Rob's gone, unless I sell it to a Rob, it's going to be pretty tough. So my wife's gym was called the Transformation Room. My screen printing business was called Nude Clothing Company. It stood for Nothing Else Will Do. You know, the Bella Boating was the name of the boat, so that goes with the boat. We have $1 million collar. We have Go Tylus. Like, all the businesses have a name that you could just transfer to another owner, and most people wouldn't be the wiser. And so that's one advice I got from my dad, because he was a jeweler and he decided he wanted to put his name on the sign. And it's just like, well, it's, once it's branded that way, it's really hard to kind of change it midstream. So just come up with a creative name that, you know, it describes the business, but is also not, you know, Ryan Co. Like,
yeah, for sure. So you've obviously had several successes. A lot of the people that I've talked to that are entrepreneurs have, you know, they obviously, everyone wants to let people know about their successes. But a lot of them often tell me also about, you know, look, they often tell me about Michael Jordan, actually. I think there was a commercial or something where it was something about, if you, you know, about all the shots he had taken and missed, but, you know, he always made the clutch ones. And it's like those ones that stand out. And businesses, I think, I guess, are somewhat similar, was the analogy they were trying to make. And so, you know, I think that's the other thing, like, for people that I've often heard, is that, you know, don't get discouraged if you hit a roadblock, like, and you know that and something's not working out, because you never know when the very next thing, like, you just have to, like you said, you don't want to burn yourself out on it, maybe, and know when it's time to move on to the next thing. And because you never know when that very next thing is going to be the one that takes off. But persistence, smart persistence, I think is kind of how I would sum up their experiences and advice to me previously.
Oh yeah. 100%. I mean, I do like massive puzzles, 13,000 pieces. Oh, wow. And it's not fun, but it's like, you know, I'll have 5,000 pieces of white and I literally have to try one after another until it fits. And so I can get really, really stubborn and I can get really ingrained in what I'm doing and focused on, okay, I need to get past this and figure this out. And if you're in business just doing it for the money, it's really easy to just be like, obstacle, screw this, I'm out, not worth it. But when you have a passion for what you're doing, that's when it's the most valuable, is when you have that adversity. I just started listening to a book called The Obstacle is the Way. And that's another thing. It's like, that is part of the process. Like, it's never going to be smooth. And if it's smooth, you're not doing it right. You're not challenging yourself. So there's always going to be obstacles. I mean, I haven't had a bad business or a bad, like, that I've started a business that failed, but I've made bad decisions in business for sure. And then it's, how do you figure that out? How do you recoup from that? How do you prevent that from happening again in the future? And so that's all part of the process. I mean, again, if you're not failing, you're not trying. And that's the way that I like to look at things.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. You've got to be willing to fail to be successful. It really feels that way. There's a reason they have a risk reward ratio in life and in things. So your boat business is here in LA, but you're not in LA, correct? So
So.
Did you exit California with everyone else in the last year or so?
Yeah. So my amazing wife is a stunt woman. So she doubles actresses on TV, movie, music videos, all kinds of things.
Wow.
And so LA has definitely over the years not been like the movie making capital, even TV making capital. I mean, I talked to a guy at Netflix. He's like, we have 800 shows in production. 80 of them are in LA. The rest are all over the world.
Yeah.
And so she got hired on a job in Atlanta, which is the movie making capital of the world. Yeah. So if you ever watch through the credits, which unless you have a stunt woman wife, you're probably not going to watch through the credits, but it always says like Georgia Peach, you know, Georgia production, blah, blah, blah. Any of those funny movies that you watch, there's just so much production here. So she gets this job for 7 weeks, and it was the longest we had been apart. We have two big dogs. We have this house in LA that we're renting. And she's just like, man, I think that there's some good business here. And I'm saying, dude, I think California is nuts and we got to get the hell out of here before it's like too nuts that we can't get out. So, you know, So she started looking for places to rent, and, you know, it's really hard with we got a 130-pound Rottweiler and a 65-pound Mastiff Pitbull, you know, breed blend thing. And, you know, it's just hard. And so what we were paying for rent in LA, we ended up buying a house that was 4 times bigger on 5 acres in Georgia. And so, you know, she's looking. She finds a house on February 28th. We closed on March 11th. She was back in LA on the 12th to help me load the truck. And I drove 3 days with two dogs across country with all of our stuff. And so in less than 2 weeks, we were bought a house, closed, and moved across country and basically said goodbye to LA. So for the beginning, I was flying back and forth every weekend to do charters. And then I ended up hooking up with a really amazing captain. The crew that I was using, she's incredible. So she took over doing all the crew stuff, and we've just made it work. So
nice.
It's been going really well. We're in the process of selling it now, but it's a little bit hard to manage from being far away. But again, we've kind of decided like, look, this was a great thing. It was fun. Let's get it to somebody in the hands of somebody who wants to grow this and really make it a business. I mean, with two more boats, easily is doing over $1 million a year in revenue. And, you know, if somebody can put those processes in place, we've got all the basic processes, the background, the booking, all that we've figured out, but getting the crew and getting the captains and, you know, there's just certain logistical things that are a little bit more complicated when you start adding multiple boats and other things. So.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's a conversation I've had with many, many, many people about just reevaluating, you know, things, especially out here in California. I mean, from a business person's perspective, the taxes, I mean, I'm in the most regulated of all industries in the nation, probably, and it taxed as well. So I probably relate to it more than most in other industries. But a lot of people really have reevaluated, you know, that cost, and you combine that with the cost of housing, and like you said, you can have your own place versus, you know, paying rent on something, you know, out here. And I think people also, once they experience. And Atlanta is a good example. You know, it's a big city. There's a lot going on there. Like you talked about the movies, the music industry's big there as well. Like there's a lot really going on in Atlanta. And I think once you visit a city like that, I mean, I grew up back east in the Southeast when I was a kid. And so I'm familiar with how that pace of life is. And even though Atlanta is a big city, like it's a little different than LA or New York or San Francisco or something. Like it's just different. And, you know, it's kind of nice. You know, you go there and it's a little slower. People are a little more relaxed and you've got all this, you know, more buying power, certainly, as the cost of living is drastically different. And I think a lot of people have started to reevaluate that, especially as they can work from home. A lot of them these days.
Yeah, I mean, look, the beauty of renting, to me, I had a really hard time getting convinced to just rent in Los Angeles. I like to own what I'm doing. I like to have that equity. But you know, as my wife pointed out after reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, it was like, look, we can rent right now for $2,500 a month, a one bedroom apartment, or you can go buy that same thing. It's going to cost, it's $1 million and it's going to cost just, you know, $7,000 a month. And it's like, dude, take that $5,000 a month and invest that somewhere. Why would you spend $5,000? You're never going to make back that money if you can invest it wisely. And the other beauty was, you know, when stuff broke, hey, this refrigerator ain't working anymore. I need, you know, we got $1,000 worth of food in here that you're going to have to replace if you don't get me something soon. And then when we decided to move, we're like, hey, we dropped an offer on a house today. I'll know in the next day or two if we're out at the end of the month. So we had a month to month lease and was like, I was gone 2 weeks, you know, the house sat empty for 2 weeks and we were out of there. And so the beauty of renting, definitely there's some benefits that most people don't think about, especially depending on the market, but LA is so insane. I mean, they just said the average price of a house in LA is, or in California is $800,000. That's insane. And so you can't even think about buying something there. So you're going to be a renter, just stick with renting and then stick money away where you can and try to get that into an investment that could return you some cash or, you know, is going to grow over time. Because it's, you know, 800 grand, you're putting 100, 150 grand down. I mean, it's a whole nother layer.
Yeah, it's really priced it out of the affordability for the average person out here. I mean, unless you're, you know, a million plus a year or close, you know, you've got to really be making money out here to be able to buy property. And I think it's made a really interesting, you know, conundrum for the country in general, because traditionally speaking, I think ownership, home ownership and real estate ownership has been one of the fastest and most effective ways for like wealth generation and to actually have financial security. And it's really kind of eluding a lot of individuals right now. And I think that's one of the reasons, again, why people are kind of reevaluating where they live if they have that option. Obviously, there are a lot of people that don't have the option to choose where they are, you know, they're a little more limited. They can't just pack up and leave. And I understand that as well. But, you know, it's a real dilemma because I think there are advantages to renting. Like for myself, like I've moved around quite a bit. I feel like I've changed cities many, 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 many times about every 3 years or so since I left Florida many years ago now. And so renting has made sense to me because I have also felt like, you know, if you own something, you might have a tendency to stay somewhere just a wee bit longer than you maybe should because you own it versus, like you said, if you're on especially a month to month lease, but even, you know, if you're on a year lease, you know, you can usually work something out. You may have to pay, you know, a couple months extra or something, but you can usually talk them down from having to pay the whole remainder of it if it's you know, depending on how litigious your landlord might be. But but there's definitely some more freedom in that, you know, because you can pick up and move and you know, jump at an opportunity if you want to.
Yeah, it's like I said before, my wife and I, once we decide something, it's like, we've changed our mind. We've decided we're moving. It's like that day can't come fast enough. And actually this time it did because I've never been to Georgia other than through the airport. So I never saw the house, I wasn't there for closing. I had nothing. She did this 100% and she did a great job. The house is amazing. And it's going to turn out to be a great investment for us as well. But, you know what, it's just, you have to be fluid. You have to be able to like, just take a risk. I mean, 6.5 years ago, I took her to LA for her birthday. We had an amazing time and we came home from that birthday trip and she said, let's do it. I said, okay, when? She said, by my next birthday. We had always met so many incredible people every time we went to LA, and we'd gone a couple times a year since we've been together, but we'd always come home and be like, God, I just met so many great, you know, great people. And you wouldn't meet that in a year in Milwaukee, where we're from. And so, you know, my screen printing business was doing great. We lived in a duplex that was always rented. So we had our mortgages covered by our tenants. We had a little boat. We had a couple cars. We had this investment property. Like, by all standards, we were on cruise control. And I brought her home from that birthday and we both said, let's do it. So we sold my screen printing business. We sold my house. We sold the boat, sold the car, sold all of our furniture and packed it up in a car. Our parents were like, are you out of your mind? Like, why would you do that right now? And we're like, why not right now? Like, what are we waiting for? And we started, or we knew nobody in Los Angeles, like nobody. The only people I was 38 years old when we moved there. I'm hanging out with 25-year-old kids that were the leasing agents, because that was the only people we knew. And we had a Rottweiler and they had German Shepherds. And I was like, all right, what are you guys doing? I mean, I'm pretty immature, so I fit in all right. But, you know, they were the only people that we knew. And it ended up being incredible because that one of those kids led to Linda becoming a stunt woman and led to, he came to work for me and we did some stuff together and he introduced me to some amazing people. He got me to Jeremy Piven's assistant, who became a huge fan of Million Dollar Collar, and it just all worked out. And we just had faith that we were going to go there and make something happen. And it was an incredible ride. And so now it's just kind of 5 years later and we're on to the next crazy thing. But so many people, like you said, find an excuse or like, oh, I'm comfortable here or I'm comfortable there or this or that. It's just like, dude, you got one shot at this life, man. You better experience as much as you possibly can.
Yeah. And
we look at it.
I agree. I also think there's a tremendous amount that can be learned, like from making a move that you don't really have any crutches to lean on when you get there. If you're moving to a city, you know, even a city that you go to and you check it out first and you secure, you know, your apartment, your living situation, but you don't know anybody there. Like, that's still a really good move. I've even done it a couple of times where I've had to find like a living situation after I moved to the city and had to sleep on a couch for a few nights until I found something, you know, in my travels, overseas. But, you know, it's such a life learning experience when you challenge yourself that way, because you don't have anybody to rely on. It's all on you. And in your case, you know, you had a partner riding with you, which is always awesome as well. But, you know, you just have to find a way to get into the right circles. And depending on that city, you know, LA, it could be anybody, like you said, it could literally be anybody that could be the person that changes, that makes the connection. It's insane, how the average person out here could be play a vital role as being a connector of people.
Oh man. I've said from before we moved there and after, you could be sitting next to Steven Spielberg's son and have no idea. You never know. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. I'm not in movies, so I don't really care about that, but who knows who he knows, who you know. I mean, I just feel like Los Angeles is such a, I know I can't do it on my own. So maybe if I help you, then maybe you'll be able to help me later. It's, to me, it's a very collaborative town. Within a couple of weeks, we had met a girl who was going on this like business networking hike. And I was like, okay, I want to network. I want to meet some people. She's like, you guys got to come. And so we went on this hike. I ended up meeting this guy, Russ. And we really hit, we talked for the whole hike. He was just intrigued about what I was doing. We started going out to lunch every once in a while. And every time I try to pay, like, I got it. I'm like, dude, what do you do? Like, what, why do you keep buying me lunch? Like, what's happening? He goes, I like your vibe. I like what you're up to. I think, you know, one day you're going to be really successful and then you'll be able to buy me lunch. And, you know, he's nonchalantly, he's like, yeah, me and my friends started a travel site back in the day called Expedia. And that has become, I mean, he's one of my closest friends. He's a mentor. He's just been, and because I said, yes, let's go on this hike. Yes, let's tell the 25-year-old kids that are the only people that we know to rent the community room at our apartment building and invite their friends. So maybe we can meet some other people. And this girl is there. She meets my wife. They hit it. It just all happened for a reason, you know, and it's because we put ourselves out there. I mean, talk about scary. My duplex cost us, I think we did it the other day. It was like $500 a month because the tax bill was about $400 and we had cable and electric to split and water and the tenants paid the rest. We went from that to $2,600 a month. I mean, that is a crazy, insane jump. Like we owned a 6,000 square foot building and our duplex and two cars and a boat. And those bills all combined weren't $2,600 a month for rent for a one bedroom apartment. So it was quite the shocker. But you know what? Like I said, you got one shot at this life and just experience as much as you possibly can.
Yeah.
You can't do that staying in the same town, same with the same friends, talking the same conversations, doing the same thing, you know, that it's just not for us.
Yeah. No. And I think once you get the itch and I, you know, it's not for everybody. I, you know, there are a lot of people that I know that are very content to, you know, live that secure, you know, content lot type of life. But you know, I think, you know, it would do, I think, the world some wonders if people were a little more exposed and would, you know, go on a vacation more than a couple hundred miles away and you know, go visit a culture they've never seen before and experience something and kind of challenge your existing beliefs a little bit. I think it's really eye-opening for people. And I know it has been for myself as well. And like you said, you've only really got one life here and, you know, you got to make the most of it.
I mean, look, we've been to Vietnam, which is beautiful. I mean, I wouldn't want to live there, but you know, it was an amazing experience to see that. We went to Cuba. We were in Cuba when COVID broke out. I mean, we were scared we weren't going to get home, but I'll tell you what, you go to Cuba and you see what all these people are talking about. And you're like, to me, Cuba was the worst place that I've ever been. It was really the dirtiest, crumbliest. I mean, I sum it up of 150-year-old homes or 100-year-old homes are eating like it's 150 years ago. I mean, it's just like potatoes and chicken and a stew. I mean, there's just not a lot of like flavor and stuff. Mm. And they're driving 75-year-old cars that are held together with duct tape. I mean, it's just like such an old, it just wasn't for us. And I hated it. Couldn't get home fast enough. We saw a lot of the country. We were out of Havana. We went a couple hundred miles down. And I mean, it's a huge island. We were seeing all this stuff. And some of these, like we went to a resort, it was all built out of concrete block. And I'm like, this is like the worst thing I've ever been to. It was shock. I mean, it was just like.
So even Havana is kind of stuck in time, so to speak, I guess.
Well, there's like the Capitol building's really nice. And there's a couple other buildings that are really nice. The hotels, there's a couple of those. But if you get a block off of that circle, there's crumbling buildings with trees growing through the middle of them because the government owns all of them and they maintain none of them. I mean, it's garbage everywhere. That's dirty. It's smelly. It's safe. It's very safe. And the beauty there was, you know, our guide said, hey, the government flat out says, look, tourism is the only money we can, as a major part of the money that we make. So if a citizen commits a crime against a tourist, whatever the penalty would be if they did it citizen to citizen is double if you do it to a tourist. Oh, so we were walking now. I mean, we walked at 1-2 in the morning, really dark, sketchy alleys that in New York City you wouldn't want to walk in, but we felt fine because we knew that they really weren't going to mess with us. So, but it was cool to see, but it's definitely not a place I ever want to live or go back to.
It's like the opposite travel advice I would usually give to somebody. Normally I would tell them to, you know, blend in and act like, you know, when in Rome, you know, you do as others do. But it sounds like in this case, you would definitely want to stand out as the American tourist and for your safety.
Yeah, bring in that American flag shirt.
Big baseball cap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So what are your thoughts on Atlanta since you've been there a few months now, and what are your thoughts on Atlanta and that culture? Vastly different than LA.
Oh, it's massively different. Yeah. I mean, but I love it. Like I worked from home in LA anyway. So other than driving to the boat and dealing with that, I was pretty much at home. So I didn't really deal with the traffic a ton, but I did enough, you know, and I love the vibe of LA. We love the beach and the ocean and all that. But I'm enjoying, you know, 5 acres, and I say my dogs get to dog all day. I mean, we went out, got an invisible fence right away, and I let them out. They just chase deer and, you know, whatever. I mean, they just are doing whatever they want to do. And so I love that. I love that I own this place and I'm getting to use my hands again. When we moved to LA, I owned a duplex and a commercial building. So I had all the tools and did everything with my hands, and I like to get in and get dirty. And so we're moving and I'm like, well, I'm moving to an apartment. I don't need this.
Sell it all.
And so now I'm like rebuilding my tool collection and just like finding projects. And I love that I get to work on my companies for most of the day. And then it's like, I got projects to do at night, and I love it. 5 acres, it takes me like 2.5 hours to cut the grass. And if I could do it every day, I would. I love getting on my 61 inch zero turn mower and knocking out the grass and getting the lines really nice. And it's definitely a slower pace, but I've enjoyed it. You know, we adapt pretty well, and we just found out that one of my soccer buddies from like 20 years ago lives 5 minutes down the street. So we reconnected, and so starting to kind of build out the friendship circle. And obviously there's a lot of stunt people that are here because there's so much production. So a bunch of people are coming from LA. So Linda's circle is getting bigger, and so it's been good. It's been fun.
You know, you mentioned mowing grass. I haven't thought about it in years. As a kid, I used to kind of hate it because I had to do it. It was, you know, a chore. But, you know, as I've thought about it, you know, there is something very therapeutic about mowing the grass. And I don't even understand it, but there is something very kind of therapeutic about it. And I haven't done it in years now. Probably more than a decade since I've mowed a lawn, but there is definitely something therapeutic to be having those things to do.
Coming out to Atlanta, I'll throw you on my zero turn. But that was probably my first job. I always forget about that, but my dad made me cut the grass, and he would only pay me $5. But then I started picking up the neighbors, and they were paying me 10 and 12 and 15 bucks to cut the grass. And I remember being, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, cutting the grass and thinking, I'm going to cut this grass so good that somebody's going to stop their car and ask me to cut their grass. And I wanted the lines to be perfect, and I wanted it to be done right. And I always remember that from being 13 years old, that I'm going to do this so well that the next person's going to ask me, the next neighbor's going to be like, yeah, you did a really good job. I mean, it didn't happen that much, but you know, I had 3 or 4 lawns that I cut once a week, and I made a little bit of money, and I hated cutting my grass because I was getting half of what I was getting paid for everybody else's. But you know, it was part of that I think my entrepreneurial journey started pretty early. My dad used to give us our allowance on Sunday night, so he would give us whatever we got, $5 for the week or whatever it was. And then there was $2.50 a day for lunch. And so we got that all on Sunday night. And so he was teaching us at 10 down to, you know, 6, 7 years old, that here's your money. You need to make this last. If you don't eat a lot, you'll have money left over at the end of the week. And if you gorge on Monday and you starve on Thursday and Friday, that's you got to, or it's going to come out of your allowance. You got to figure that out. And so very fortunate that he was wise enough to kind of start doing that at a very young age for us.
Yeah, there's something to be said for, you know, kind of learning those kind of skills at a young age and having them kind of ingrained into you, managing money, critical thinking, these things that seem, I don't know, maybe a little bit missing. Thinking back on it, I can remember my dad, he didn't pay me that much. Actually, he used to tell me that he was going to make sure that I wanted to go to college, which it worked. So, you know. That is what it is.
Yeah, they all had different motivations. I don't know how my dad reverse engineered. He had this thing when we went to a restaurant. So there's 4 of us. I'm the oldest and there's 5 years down to the youngest in between. And four of us would be at dinner and people would literally come to our table and be like, you have the most well-behaved children I've ever seen. And I remember him telling us this story that for kids that wanted to, there was a slop house in the back of every restaurant and you could throw food and you could yell and scream and do all this stuff. And somehow he made it sound like the worst place on earth. And we just sat there, we held our forks and knives perfectly. And we ate our meals. Like, I don't want to go back there. I want to stay here with you. I don't know what reverse psychology he used on us, but it sure did work because I could tell you almost every time we went out, somebody would come and say, you have the most well-behaved kids I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, you'll have some, there are some excellent places to use those eating manners in Atlanta. There's definitely some good food down there. So you'll have
that. Yeah, we're starting to explore. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where can people tell? So what is next on the horizon for you? And I think you said your wife has something that's coming up as well.
Yes, she's got something that's really exciting. She's also got her gym. It's called the Transformation Room. She came up with, you know, she'd be on set all day and obviously can't do a big, you know, hour long workout or half hour even. So she developed these really amazing 10-minute, just get the blood pumping workouts that you wouldn't really sweat, but you're going to work 8 or 9 body parts at a time and just feel really great. It's called the Transformation Room. You can go get it's $10 a month or something. And there's a ton of all these 10-minute videos. And you can just go and just pop them on your phone and just watch a 10-minute video and knock out a quick workout. Everybody says that they don't have time in the day. Everybody's got 10 minutes. And so it's brilliant. It's just a takeoff of what her gym was back in Milwaukee. For $1 million collar, we've actually expanded out and started our own dress shirt line called Go Tyless. We had all of our inventory right before COVID. Exploded. Everybody stopped advertising right when we got back from Cuba. So we doubled down on our advertising. We sold through 85% of our inventory and had such spotty sizes that we just kind of took it back down and took off all the ads. We couldn't get any more product made. So we actually took a little pivot in the company. And instead of competing with Ralph Lauren, we actually designed and our manufacturer, I don't know if you can see it in this photo, but
yeah,
I can digitally print any logo on fabric. So unlike a screen printed or embroidered left chest logo for your company shirt, I take your logo. We actually print out the fabric 36 inches wide, 50 yards long of that logo repeating. And then we cut the pieces of the shirt out of that for the collar band, the inside of the placket and inside of the cuffs, digitally printed, sew the shirts together. They're totally custom. They're amazing. They're only $50 a shirt because we're just trying to get the first ones out. The first round we did for Make-A-Wish Foundation, they're talking about going nationwide with it as a fundraising opportunity. The head guy was like, this is the coolest shirt I've ever seen. And it's incredible how detailed the print is, but basically any colors, we have extra small to triple XL and small and slim and standard. It's amazing. It's 50 shirts, $50 a shirt. So it's $2,500 order, but it's just something that nobody else is doing. And so if you've got a bar or a restaurant or a hotel, or you're an influencer or a bank or any business that just wants a good looking shirt, that's not so like a trade show shirt.
Exactly.
We've got the stuff. And obviously $1 million collar is already built in, but I'm going to wear this out in no time because I love this freaking shirt. Everybody talks about it.
I mean, people have been doing this with the, you know, with the collars and the inner sleeve for a long time to do, you know, contrasting things to give it a little bit of an edge. So, I mean, this is, you know, because honestly, I've been sitting here watching and I've kind of wondered what the pattern was on your collar, on the inside of your collar for the whole time we've been talking. So, it's definitely something that if somebody takes notice, they're going to be like, what is that? And then it's like the lead in. So it's like perfect for that sort of thing. And I
took my dad on a trip a couple of weeks ago to New York to do this golfing thing. And we checked into the hotel and the lady was like, oh my God, that shirt's amazing. I said, that's my shirt. I made it. Who does your uniform? Let's talk to him.
Yeah, for sure.
It's really cool. It's unlike anything else. The quality is insane. They're made in Turkey. I mean, they are just off the charts. They're amazing shirts.
Awesome. And, you know, you said it's called the Transformation Room.
Yep.
Yep. I mean, this, I am encouraging of anyone to get in better shape. I think like, it's not exactly my style. I'm a little more, get up at 4:30 in the morning and go punish myself for a hard hour, hour and a half, and, get a nice hard sweat, you know, going, so it's not necessarily my style, but there are so many people that just, like you said, that it, and it is hard. That's why I do that. It's hard to find the time to fit it in the day. And so, and I think for many people, I've been active my whole life. I used to do personal training many in another lifetime ago, it seems like. So for me, it's not, it's kind of part of my life, but for a lot of people that haven't been, you know, didn't play sports growing up, they, you know, haven't been active in a long time. I think it's a very daunting thing for them. So I think if they can find a way to work it in and it not be so physically intimidating as well, as far as the workout, I think that can be a tremendous thing. So I highly encourage people to check it out. And you can, it's just Google it, or is it transformationroom.com?
Transformation Room Fit, fitness, transformationroomfit.com. Yeah, I mean, they're, look, it's even 10 minutes. Trust me, try it. And you're like, damn, like I didn't think that in 10 minutes I could feel this good. And it's really intended for like that, you know, if you get an hour for lunch, you can take 10 minutes right before you eat and just get the blood flowing. It'll make that second half of the day go. Or, you know, you get home from work and it's like, I don't want to work out for an hour. But getting the blood pumping. And like you said, I mean, every little bit of fitness is a step in the right direction. We've got a lot of people that were members at her gym that are like, you know, 10 minutes isn't enough. Well, do two videos, do three videos.
Yeah.
We used to do 30-minute classes.
Yeah.
Do three videos back to back to back. And they're all categorized. So if you want cardio, you want to work on your legs, you want to work on your abs, she's got the resume of resumes. I mean, just ripped six-pack abs. I mean, she's been shredded her whole life. She's been into fitness. And she did it from a point of passion, because it wasn't a, you know, I think a lot of people that are in fitness just do it because they love it. And she, I mean, she worked out a lot in college. She's always had these abs, and people are always like, how do I get six pack abs? Well, it's not that easy.
There's not a pill for it.
Yeah. And so while she was at her corporate job, when we first met, she was studying. When she was on the plane, when she was at night, she was studying to get her personal training license, got certified and all that stuff, and started her own gym. And she left an amazing corporate job with 5-star perks for everything to start her own gym. I mean, it's amazing watching her journey too. And she's coming back after having done, you know, stunts and doing all the stuff to get back at the gym. Because all those people that worked out with her at her gym are like, I need more. We need, what are you doing? Do some videos, do an online thing. So it's pretty cool. It's fun.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for just, I don't want to get in anything too controversial, but you know, I think it is very important though as well, given the last couple years that we've had, you know, just based on the fact that a lot of the most affected people with COVID have seemed to be, you know, people that have been obese. I think it's like 78% of the people who have died have been obese. And so, you know, just getting up and moving, you know, getting your, like you said, getting your blood flowing, even if you're not a workout holic. Like for me, I think it's as much mental therapy as it is anything, you know, putting yourself through extreme hardship, extreme physical exertion, I think is a little bit like mental therapy, in the way that once you're done that, everything else seems like it just is so much easier. It's not as big of a deal, you know. But I, you know, even like you said, at lunch, you know, I think people would be amazed if you just get up and move around for a few minutes and get your blood flowing and get the heart rate up. You know, you don't have to necessarily break a sweat, but you'll also find, I think, that it kind of suppresses your appetite a bit. I think people sometimes eat out of boredom. And, you know, if you're being active and you're really busy, I know that days when I don't have as much going on, you know, you're tempted to boredom eat. And days when you're packed, your schedule's packed and it's one thing after the other, you go almost all day and not eat, and you don't almost miss it even.
Yeah, absolutely. You're just like, oh my God, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I haven't eaten anything yet today except for coffee this morning. And you're just going on that adrenaline. So definitely something to be said about that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you. I want to be cautious of your time. I appreciate, I know you're a busy guy, and You know, I love what you're doing with Million Dollar Caller. I love what your wife's got going on as well. You know, be sure tell people one more time where they can check out both of those online.
MillionDollarCaller.com has all the options. So we've got our mail-in service, we've got our shirts, we've got the product straight up. So we've got all of those ways to get Million Dollar Caller. If you're outside of the country, Amazon, we're worldwide on Amazon, so it's really easy to get it there. And then Linda's at Transformation Room Fit. Go check her out. 10-minute workouts. Change your life.
Awesome.
One step at a time. 10 minutes at a time.
It's all happens in little increments. Change is the only constant. There's no need to fight it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. And we'll have to do this again when you sell the company, or maybe we bring her on and at some point if she's interested as well. She sounds like she's had an interesting journey and probably have a lot to banter about as far as fitness goes.
Oh yeah, get into that with her, and we'll when the new thing comes out, we'll reach out. You'll love it.
Awesome. Look forward to it. Well, thanks so much again. Have a great day and an awesome holiday weekend as well.